Good evening, everyone. I'm Priya Menon, the scientific media editor of the Cure Talk blog and its Cure Panel talk show. I welcome all of you to the Indian edition of the Cure Panel talk show. Started in New York in August 2012, the Cure Panel talk show is broadcast live on Blog Talk Radio and brings together experts and patients for a discussion on important topics in healthcare and medical research. The show has hosted eminent physicians and researchers from leading medical centers such as Harvard Medical School, Mayo Clinic, MD Anderson, Washington University, and well-known patient advocates such as Pat Killingsworth of the Multiple Myeloma blog and Gary Peterson of MyelomaSurvival.com for discussions on topics ranging from multiple myeloma, prostate cancer to yoga and cancer nutrition. The show has been replayed and heard over 100,000 times. And we are excited to launch the Indian edition of the show with a panel on diabetes today. Diabetes is the most common metabolic disorder in the world, and India has been dubbed the diabetes capital of the world with over 62 million individuals diagnosed with the condition. And the alarming part of the story is that this number is almost 5 times less than the number of people who go undiagnosed. With diabetes being diagnosed in rural areas where healthcare resources are scarce, India is heading towards a burgeoning diabetes epidemic. Creating awareness regarding the condition and preventing its occurrence stands first in the list of actions to be taken to curb this menace from devouring India. And we begin this today with a discussion on understanding type 2 diabetes with none other than Dr. Milind G. Watve. Dr. Watve is biologist at Indian Institute of Science, Education and Research, Pune. Dr. Watve's book, Doves, Diplomats and Diabetes, challenges the current understanding of diabetes and prods researchers to test his alternative model. So would Dr. Watve's perspectives help researchers in curbing occurrence of type 2 diabetes or maybe even hint at a cure? Dr. Watve, welcome to the show.
Hi, Priya. Hi, everyone.
Hello, Dr. Watve. The topic for today's discussion is type 2 diabetes and behavior, a Darwinian perspective. Dr. Watve, I would say that your observations regarding type 2 diabetes is truly amazing. But, sir, why do you think there is a need to look at diabetes from a different perspective?
Yes. Our understanding of diabetes has grown over years, and it is science. Okay. And in science, science is always open to new challenges. A hypothesis is supported for some time, but whenever there is new evidence, science is open to drop an old hypothesis and adapt a new one. Okay. Now, over the last 15 years, a number of experiments have actually challenged the current understanding, the current hypothesis of type 2 diabetes, and I think it is time to think of an alternative. For example, it's believed that type 2 diabetes is because of insulin resistance. That is, the tissue response to insulin is reduced. Although insulin levels might be normal, even above normal, but the tissues that are dependent on insulin to pick up glucose respond less and less to insulin. So this is called insulin resistance, and that is supposed to be central to type 2 diabetes. But in some of the experiments, they knocked out insulin receptors in the muscle of mice. Okay, now this is, muscle is the main organ that is dependent on insulin to pick up glucose. Now if insulin receptors are knocked out, that is a condition which is equivalent to insulin resistance. And then you expect that insulin levels would go up in order to compensate for this insulin resistance. And if that doesn't happen, then sugar should go up. But then, surprisingly, nothing happens. You knock out the insulin receptor, that is, you make the mouse insulin resistant, and nothing happens in the insulin resistant mouse. Neither insulin nor sugar levels go up. Then, there are other experiments which show that if a person, well, these experiments are done both in rodents as well as in humans. So if a person is insulin resistant and also has high levels of insulin, now if you suppress the level of insulin by some means, by some intervention, and different types of interventions have been used, Now, if you suppress insulin production, you expect that now the sugar level should go up. But what happens in the experiments is very different. The moment you suppress insulin production, insulin sensitivity increases and sugar remains normal. Okay, this shows that the classical belief that insulin resistance and inadequate insulin production is responsible for high sugar levels in type 2 diabetes is actually not true. And this has been shown independently by different research groups using different ways of suppressing insulin, using different models. So some experiments are in humans, some are in rats, and it works the same way in all the systems. So the classical assumption is being challenged now. Okay, and this is a major challenge. Well, the other thing is, it doesn't matter. If you can cure the patient, then actually whether it is scientifically sound or not doesn't matter. Ultimately, a clinician is interested in curing the patient. But then, we haven't found any cure. Now, why is it that there is no cure for diabetes? Well, there can be three reasons. One is, if there is something that is irreversible by nature, so if something happens and then there is just no way to return. So, for example, in the human eye, the retina cannot regenerate. So, if there is retinal damage, that is irreversible. Is that so in diabetes? Well, people believe that beta cell loss is irreversible. But now people show, now it has been shown again very reproducibly, that beta cells have a good capacity to regenerate, which means that beta cell loss is not reversible. Insulin resistance is not irreversible. Well, both are not irreversible, which means that there is nothing which is irreversible by nature. Then, is it that we don't have the technology to do this? That is also not true, because there are drugs and there are interventions which have successfully been shown to reverse insulin resistance. So insulin resistance can be reversed, beta cell loss also can be reversed, then why is type 2 diabetes not curable? Well, the third possibility is perhaps our understanding itself is wrong. And that is appearing to be the most logical possibility now.
So, Dr. Vachis, you're saying that insulin and sugar may not be at the root of type 2 diabetes. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yes. So, history has some effect on our thinking. So, the first thing that became known about diabetes was sugar, right? This was followed by insulin. Well, before that, there was a demonstration that some change in the brain causes a tremendous rise in blood sugar. But that was more or less forgotten. Okay. So what was known for a long time is the relationship between sugar and insulin. And then everyone started thinking that it is only sugar and insulin that is central to type 2 diabetes. Today we know that there are a large number of molecules, something between 60 and 70 different molecules, whose levels either go up or go down in diabetes. And we still do not know what is the cause and what is the effect, right? So sugar and insulin are only two of these 60 or more than 60 molecules that change in diabetes. Now, why should we believe that diabetes is all about sugar and insulin? It is about this entire network of changes that takes place in the body, right? So this is a new paradigm. So now we are moving away from insulin and glucose, not completely away, but the view is being expanded. So now we need to have a perspective of all these molecules, think of all of them, at least at the research level, and realize what is happening.
Okay, I think that is where your new alternative model comes in. So what is the new alternative model? And where does it have its origin?
Yeah, it's funny. The new model comes from wild animals. Well, I have been a wildlife enthusiast and I spent a number of years of my life and research in wild elephants, also tigers and a number of animals. And that made me think a lot about health in the wild. Okay, so during my PhD, I was working on parasites of wild animals. Then from infectious diseases, my thinking came to non-infectious diseases, but the thinking remained the same, that ecology has a lot to do with health. The concept of animals being used to understand human physiology and human disease is not new. But all these animals are lab animals, they are confined in cages, and you manipulate them. But in the last 10-15 years, data has been started accumulating on health parameters of wild animals, and that is a lot revealing. In the wild, there are various behavioral strategies. Not all animals are the same. Animals have differences, they have personalities or behavioral syndromes. And after a debate for several decades, now people have started realizing that animals in the wild have personalities. They have individual characters, which are different between individuals, and an individual retains some characteristic throughout life. Well, one of such behavioral dichotomies is that of hawk and dove. Okay. So hawk and dove first came from theory. Then people showed that hawk and dove exist in animal societies in nature. Hawk is an aggressive individual. Dove is an aggression avoider. Okay, and both these personalities can exist in the same troop of primates, for example. So there is an alpha male which is dominant and aggressive, and there are subordinate males who are weaker, but who coexist, who also stay in the group. Okay, the alpha male is said to have most of the access to females, and therefore his reproductive success is more. And the subordinate males, for a long time, people thought that they are losers. Okay, they don't have access to females, so they cannot reproduce. Well, after DNA techniques came in, people realized that that is not really true. Although the alpha male is still better in reproduction, but the subordinate males are not outright losers. They can also make substantial, they also gain substantial success by what is called sneak mating. Okay, so if they are physically weak, they try to make up with their social smartness. So these are the two types of phenotypes. Either you are physically strong, dominant, aggressive, or you are physically weak, aggression avoider, but you tend to make it up by being socially smart. Right? So this is called hawk and dove in animal societies. When it comes to human societies, we started calling it soldier and diplomat personalities. They don't refer to professions, they refer to your nature. So some individuals, and if you look through human history, then earlier, majority of the individuals were of the soldier type. They were more muscle dependent. They were more dependent on their physical strength and physical activity to gain a livelihood. The other kind of personality, which is called a diplomat personality, depends more on social smartness, on social cognition, social manipulation to earn your living. Well, look at hawk and dove kind of animals in the wild, and you find that both these types of behaviors are associated with very different physiological states. So the soldier, for example, the hawk, the dominant animal, is typically insulin sensitive, has low levels of serotonin, high level of dopamine, has high sex hormones, is low in cortisol, is low in cholesterol. So all this has been demonstrated with plenty of data across a variety of species. When it comes to humans, you find similar things. People who are physically active, physically aggressive, are more insulin sensitive, have low cholesterol, low cortisol. On the other hand, people who are more socially manipulative have the other kind of physiological setup, and they are more likely to be insulin resistant. Okay, now this is a generalization that has come out of a large number of studies and seems to be fairly robust across species. So, essentially, it is the behavioral strategy that makes up the physiological state. And this is not without reason. This is quite adaptive. So, a number of molecules which are associated with the metabolic syndrome that include insulin, cholesterol, leptin, cortisol, all of them have important roles in cognitive behavior. they shape behavior. Experiments have shown that if you keep glucose constant and change the insulin level, insulin has an effect on behavior, and this has been shown in humans as well, right? So if you infuse insulin, but at the same time keep the glucose level constant, that changes the behavior. Okay? So all these molecules have a behavioral role, and evolution has shaped metabolism to suit the behavioral strategy that you adapt. Okay, so in humans, we call that there are these two types of strategies, metaphorically, called soldier strategy and diplomat strategy. And a soldier is typically insulin sensitive, diplomat is typically insulin resistant. Okay, now that is the baseline of this new thinking.
Okay, that is truly different. So how long did it take to actually come up with something so very different and so very out of the way, I'm sure, because anybody now, the standard medical procedure is to certainly look at insulin levels and blood sugar levels.
Yes.
When did you actually come up with something that behavior could be behind, developing type 2 diabetes?
Yes, well, that has a long history. My background is not that of medicine. My background is of basic biology, and I worked for a number of years in the wild with wild animals. So that was in my mind all the time. Then in 2001, I came in touch with a diabetes research group through a very different context. But once I started looking at their data, I thought that, well, I can see ecology in this. And the leader of that group called Dr. Chittaranjan Yadnik, who is a leading diabetes researcher, I asked him, is it okay if I look at your data as an ecologist? And he was all encouraging. He said, yes, go ahead, see what you feel. Let us talk about it. Let us discuss. Let us see whether anything new comes out of it. And it took a long time. 2001, we started interacting. Then we published our first hypothesis in 2007. And okay. Then this book this year. So it's almost 12 years that I'm in this. And every now and then, I feel that, I realize something new. Okay. There is some new subtlety that I was unable to make out. Well, today, I found that, there is an explanation for this, which is coherent with the rest of the thinking. And I was thinking that this will come to a sort of a saturation level. Well, I would say that, okay, I have said everything that I want to say, but that is somehow not happening. New things are coming up, new thinking is coming up, new hypothesis, new evidence is coming up every now and then.
According to you, why do you think we are seeing a rise in type 2 diabetes?
A very clear answer is there is a change in the social systems. Okay, along with change in diet and along with reduction in physical activity. But reduction in physical activity and diet are not the only factors. There is much more to that. Okay, and that much more is mainly a behavioral change and a social change. Until a couple of generations ago, our day-to-day activities involved a number of neuromuscular activities, that of a hunter-gatherer. So, for example, there are simple aggressive acts like cutting wood for fire, okay, driving away animals to protect your farm, to protect your food, and so on, right? Now, these are simple, driving a horse or a bullock cart. These are simple aggressive acts which are remnants of our Stone Age activities. Right? Today, we have lost all of them. So, this is something that I call behavioral deficiency. And behavioral deficiencies are much like dietary deficiencies. You need something, your metabolism, your body needs a factor which normally should come from the diet, but you take such a diet which doesn't supply that, and you develop a dietary deficiency. Similarly, all our body systems are tuned to certain kinds of behaviors, and this tuning happened when we were in the Stone Age. So we still have the Stone Age bodies, and our systems are tuned to that kind of behavior. For example, if you are aggressive, you anticipate injuries, because if you are aggressive, then even the opponent will be aggressive. If you anticipate injuries, then factors, a number of peptides and a number of proteins called EGF, NGF, and a large number of growth factors are secreted in anticipation of wounds. Now, when we have given up this aggressive behavior for decades together, so for example, after I left school, I don't remember having fought with anyone. So when you give up certain behaviors for decades together, then these factors start becoming deficient. And actually there is data that these growth factors, EGF, NGF and other growth factors which are needed in wound healing are going down in the population, and particularly so in diabetics. Okay, so when there is a behavioral deficiency, the entire body chemistry starts changing.
Mm-hmm.
So we are developing, the society is developing such kinds of behavioral deficiencies, and I think that is the main reason not only for type 2 diabetes, but a large number of other modern disorders, which are called lifestyle disorders.
These constitute the risk factors, I guess.
Yes, but okay, risk factor is a funny word. I will agree that these are risk factors, but these are not only risk factors, they are causal as well.
Okay, so even obesity would be causing type 2 diabetes then?
Well, about obesity, the picture is funny. Now, people have talked a lot about obesity, which is not without an element of truth, but that is not the only thing that matters. So, for example, there is good amount of data on sumo wrestlers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sumo wrestlers have a high BMI. They are fat. They also have a lot of abdominal fat. So, they have a big tummy. And overall, they are muscular as well as they accumulate a large amount of fat. But in spite of having a large amount of fat, they are quite insulin sensitive for a person of a comparable BMI, but who is not a non-wrestler, right? So their wrestling, which is an aggressive act, keeps them insulin sensitive, although their BMI is high. On the other hand, particularly in India, it is very, very common to find a normal weight diabetic. Even a thin diabetic is not uncommon
yes.
in India. And it's not only in India, even in other countries, a condition called as metabolically obese but normal weight. Okay, normal weight metabolically obese is a known condition. So, you see all the metabolic effects of pre-diabetes, but the person is not obese. So, which means that obesity is not, does not have a one-to-one linkage with diabetes, but it's a risk factor. And the reason why it is a risk factor, I think, is the causal factors that lead to obesity and the causal factors that lead to type 2 diabetes have a large overlap. So there is a correlation. But correlation does not necessarily mean causation. That is the difference.
So if you're saying a behavioral deficiency, once we supplement this, do you think we are looking towards a cure for type 2 diabetes? Or in other words, do you think diabetes can become curable in the future?
Theoretically, yes. Because, as I said earlier, there is nothing in diabetes which is not reversible. So, in principle, diabetes should be completely reversible. The reason we are unable to reverse it today is we haven't understood all the links completely. And behavioral deficiency, the concept of behavioral deficiency is very parallel to dietary deficiencies. And therefore, just as dietary deficiencies can be cured by giving a pill, okay, we should be able to cure behavioral deficiencies by giving behavioral pills. And a behavioral pill is nothing but making up for the lost behavior in some way, and that the best way is sport. Best way is exercise, but not exercise for burning fat, not exercise for spending calories, exercise to make up the lost behaviors. So, for example, the behaviors that we have lost are physical aggression is number one. Then we have lost risk-taking or adventure. Okay. Then we have also lost injury-proneness. we have also lost quick reflexes, agility, swiftness, right? Now, these are the behavioral deficiencies. And these behavioral deficiencies can be made up using playing the right kind of sport. A sport that involves actions, well, most of the active sport mimic actions of a hunter or a fighter, right? So sports involves chasing, catching, punching, kicking, hitting, throwing with an aim, escaping, right? All these are acts that we, our social life has lost, but we can make up by playing the right kind of sport.
That's really interesting. So would you suggest making or designing workout regimes which would involve aggression and risk-taking
right.
behavior?
Right, right. Right. Okay. So that's what we are currently working on. Okay. Designing a set of exercises specifically for diabetes and other behavioral deficiencies. And the important thing is, you have to cater for people of all ages and all kinds of body conditions, right? Advanced diabetics are not in a physical state to play football, okay? They are not in a physical state where they can do wrestling with someone. So we need to have a range of activities that can be played by people of all types of body condition and all age classes, right? This is a big task, and my research is going in this direction now.
Okay. That's really, really very interesting and very hopeful also, actually. So this is a very different kind of thinking for type 2 diabetes. How has it been accepted with people you're interacting and researchers, the pharmacists who are into diabetes? Yes. How do you think it has been accepted?
Yeah, that is interesting. Actually, for a long time, I thought that nobody will listen to me. And so I started writing about it without expecting much. But then, of late, I have been giving talks to some hardcore diabetes research groups, including institutes, including university departments, including pharma R&D divisions, and what I see is a picture where people are quite aware of the limitations and the flaws in the current thinking. And I found that they are looking for alternatives. So, for example, in a pharma R&D group, which is a type 2 diabetes R&D group, I said that I will divide my talk in two parts. In the first part, I will try to convince you that the current thinking is wrong. And only if you are convinced, we'll go to the second part. Otherwise, we'll leave it at that. So I talked for about, I consumed almost the first hour that my talk was scheduled and said that, okay, let me stop now. And if you are convinced, we'll go to the second part, which is what is the alternative thinking. Well, they said that we are not surprised. Okay, so somewhere we know that the current thinking is wrong. It doesn't work. But it was never so explicit. It was never brought together to form a synthesis and to say that, well, we need a paradigm shift now. So somewhere this hunger is there. People are looking for alternatives, but it will take a long time to settle and decide exactly which alternative is right. And that is the process of research. It will take maybe one or two more decades.
When you're talking about exercises that you're currently working on or designing so that we can incorporate or supplement the behavioral deficiencies.
Yes.
What type, as you said, aggressive, not the... What do you think about yoga? Because we do conduct panels on yoga, and yoga, I think we have had people talking about how it can cure or provide relief to a lot of metabolic disorders.
Yes.
So what is your opinion on this?
Yes. So I'm not particularly any expert on yoga. Whatever I have seen and heard is yoga itself is quite heterogeneous and it has a large number of components, right? So there is a component taking you towards meditation, right? But there's another component that takes aggressive postures, right?
Okay.
And so yoga itself has a behavioral diversity. And so when you are doing something that is behaviorally diverse, it is quite likely that you are making up for some of the deficient behaviors. But this is a very tentative remark because I am not an expert in yoga.
Okay. What would be a take-home message for preventing and treating type 2 diabetes?
For preventing, it is very, I'm very certain about it. You need to play the right kind of sport. And the nature of sport that we see today is not what I recommend. In today's sport, half a dozen or a dozen people play and there are a million watchers. We should have games where there is participation. Large number participate. Okay. Just being a spectator is not enough. You need to participate. You need to play. And this is not for competitive purpose. Okay. Since sport has become too competitive, people think that, it is worth playing only if you are a national champion. That's not so. Play for your own sake. Your own health, your own rejuvenation.
Yes, that's a very good thing, sir. Playing sport added to your routine for being healthy.
Yes.
At this point, I would like to introduce the panelists and bring them on air. We have with us Dr. Pramod Patil. He is MD in physiology. He has worked on insulin resistance and beta cell function indices in Indian diabetics. Since last couple of years, he is intimately associated with diabetic research with Dr. Milind Watve and his team. His special interests lie in behavioral origin of modern day diseases, growth factors, hyperinsulinemia, non-metabolic functions of insulin, and evolutionary physiology. He is also active in the field of wildlife research and conservation and is known for his work on critically endangered bird species. Dr. Pramod is also co-hosting the show with me today. We also have Radha Desai, who is a neuroscientist with a strong background in diverse disciplines of biology. She is currently pursuing a PhD at University College London, focusing on understanding the role of mitochondrial pathology in neuroinflammation. She has worked in early drug discovery, neuroscience, biomarker biology, and clinical research, and has a continuing interest in drug development right from early preclinical research all the way to clinical development. We also have with us Dr. Mohini Shukla, who is assistant professor in the Developmental and Brain Sciences Program in the Psychology Department at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He received his MS in Biological Sciences from the Indian Institute of Science, Bangalore, India, and then went on to receive a PhD in Cognitive Neuroscience at the Cesare Trieste, Italy. Dr. Shukla is primarily interested in the biological basis and development of cognitive capacities, in particular human language. He has published several peer-reviewed papers and book chapters, particularly in the field of language development, and has been invited to lecture in various labs and conferences internationally. Dr. Shukla is one of the three PIs of the UMass Boston Baby Lab studying infant development. Next, we have Richa Modak, who works as a dietetic intern at the University of Michigan Health System. She completed her master's in public health from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, during which she also worked on diabetes from a public health perspective in Pune, India. She has also completed her bachelor's in microbiology and master's in biodiversity from Abba Saheb Garhwale College, Pune, India, and accomplished a number of projects under the guidance of Dr. Milind Watve. She assisted him on his work on type 2 diabetes with IISER in the summer of 2010. I welcome all the panelists to the show. Great to have all of you here. Before I hand over to Pramod, I would like to remind the listeners that at the end of the discussion, we will be taking in questions. And if you have a question for our panel, please press 1 on your keypad and we will bring you live on air to ask your question. Pramod will now begin with the panel discussion. Pramod, you are on air.
Thanks, Priya. Thanks, Dr. Milind Watve. Now, it's really warm discussion that I expect that will go on. This concept, as all of us we know, though have taken so many years to develop, but it's really quite recent for Indian people or the Asian people. And I believe that the highest incidence and prevalence of this disease in the Asia needs to be addressed very accurately on the basis of this newly proposed theory. I have basic questions in my mind, and I would really like to ask Dr. Vatve. Now, as this theory suggests that diplomat stress or diplomat behavior is rather the key origin of this entire disease, and all of us we know that the diplomat behavior basically is the essential part of our livelihood, the essential part of our lifestyle, and it will not be possible to change the entire it will not be possible to change the entire social system to cure diabetes, because that is not in our hands. So how do you look at it? I mean, if you really know that diplomat tendency is a need of time, how do you look at the curing of disease on this current system, which we cannot change, but how can we cure the disease if we are not able to reduce the diplomat behavioral stress in our lifestyle?
Yes. Well, we can learn something from centuries of diet research. Our diet had changed substantially, and we have developed several deficiencies. Okay, so for example, vegetarian people have developed, seem to have developed deficiency of vitamin B12. Okay, and this is particularly true, seems to be true for India. People are saying this across studies. Well, does it mean that all vegetarians should give up vegetarianism and go back to, certainly not. If you are deficient in B12, then there are other means for making up for that deficiency. Right? So similarly, we don't have to change our entire social systems and behavioral patterns and so on. We just need to identify which behaviors we need to make up and bring them in through exercise and games and other activities. Right? So we don't have to give up diplomat behavior. We don't have to give up brain-centered life. But we need to make up by spending some part of the time of the day into activities which are soldier-like.
Okay. That's really a good thing. I mean, so in the perspective, it is the need to fulfill all these behavioral deficiencies, not by reducing the diplomat because diplomat stress, because it is not possible to us, but we really need to introduce the physical aggressive component in our lifestyle.
Yes.
So I have a second question. Like, I mean, as per your theory, if the diabetes or the metabolic syndrome or the insulin resistance is basically an adaptation to this brain-dependent lifestyle, so because it helps us to be brain-dependent people, but how do we land up in complications then? If it is an adaptation, if it is getting adapted on a larger scale by this species on entire globe, how do you find, I mean, why this is leading to the complications if it is an adaptation?
Yes. Well, there are so many examples where what evolved as an adaptation later turned out to be detrimental because it was out of context. And there are examples from animal behavior that you can easily fool an animal to behave stupidly. And this is because the behavior evolved for one set of conditions. But then you present the animal with an entirely different set of conditions, but the evolved behavior still presents itself, and it leads to a very absurd behavioral phenomenon, which is sometimes called supernormal response. So, for example, some experimenters gave a football-sized egg to an incubating gull female, and the egg was exactly marked as a true egg, just that it was too large. So the gull female apparently ignored her own eggs and tried to incubate the false egg, which was too large. Well, this we do. When we watch a movie on a big screen, then why does our adrenaline go up or go down? Okay, that is a kind of supernormal response. So we know that we give supernormal response. We get involved into seeing things which we know quite well that they are not true. This is only a movie, this is only a novel, but we still get involved, right? Now, this is the way our body and mind responds to supernormal stimuli. And there is an optimum for everyone, for everything, right? So if a response evolved as being adaptive, it evolved to an optimum. But if it is stretched beyond the optimum, if too much of anything is bad, well, people have demonstrated that even water, just drinking too much of water can be bad for health. Right? So the most essential and the most harmless factor, the most harmless intake, and that is water. Too much of water can kill a person. Right? So something like this is happening. The response which was adaptive once, today we are stretching it rather beyond limits where it turns bad, where it turns pathological.
Thanks, Dr. Atwe. So I have another question. Like nowadays, we talk not only about diabetes, but we talk about number of other diseases which are really correlated to each other. They come with, you know, they're associated to each other. We have also defined metabolic syndrome or syndrome X. So I would like to ask a question. Like now we are talking of diabetes, but do you find that modern day diseases do have a behavioral origin? And are there any other diseases apart from diabetes that might have behavioral origin?
It's quite likely. And we know some of the pathways. So, for example, aggression changes the serotonin-dopamine ratio in the brain. This is quite well known. And then it is also known that dopamine strengthens the bone, whereas serotonin weakens the bone. So it is quite likely that a behavioral change brings about a change in these, which and because of which you end up in weaker bones. So osteoponia, osteoporosis could be a result of change in the brain monoamines, which is a result of change in behavior. Right? So there are certain pathways, and these pathways have been demonstrated, but so which raise the possibility that a number of things, which include osteopenia, PCOS is another thing, because we know that in wild primates, there is a phenomenon called ovulation suppression. And typically, weaker and subordinate females suppress ovulation, which is very parallel, even mechanistically, hormonally, very parallel to PCOS in young girls in the modern society. So it is quite likely that even PCOS has a behavioral origin. Then there is chronic fatigue syndrome. Even cancers involve molecules which have behavioral connections. So it is quite likely that a large number of disorders have behavioral links.
Okay. This is really interesting, because we need to look at this not in, only in the perspective of diabetes, but if the behavior is going to have a wider impact on our entire life and survival and the disease pattern, then definitely we really need to change, we really need to shift the paradigm of thinking on the medical modern diseases. So this was really, really helpful for us to understand the entire origin of this concept, and along with that, the modern-day lifestyle and its relation to our modern-day diseases, and not through only in the perspective of exercise and calorie-burning exercise, rather. So we were expecting Radha to join us. Yeah, so we were expecting Radha to join us, but she was unable to join us, but we have her questions with us, sent via email, and I would like to ask these questions on behalf of Radha. She has asked that, the categorization of individuals into DIV and diplomats seems to be a phenomenon that develops on two fronts, the systemic hormonal and the brain circuitry. Although not independent of each other, in the light of diseases like schizophrenia and bipolar disorders, which are increasingly thought to precipitate during adolescence because of miswiring, do you reckon adolescence might be the crucial time in an individual's life where, developmentally speaking, these phenotypes like doves and diplomats might be consolidating themselves? So do you, I think, in brief, do you believe or do you think that the adolescence is the time where these types of behavioral dichotomy or these types of behavioral strategies might be getting adapted by an individual?
Yes, I would like to agree. People have talked about metabolic programming, but most of the work is on metabolic programming in early life, that is intrauterine and early infancy. There is metabolic programming, and there is plenty of evidence showing that there is metabolic programming. But I believe that that is not the only stage in which metabolic programming takes place. It perhaps happens throughout life, and adolescent stage is one where your personality is developing, personality is getting a shape. So it is very likely that that has effect on metabolism and long-term effects on metabolism in particular.
Okay.
Health is, after all, a cumulative effect of history. And it begins in early life. Actually, it begins in parental life. Because now people have shown that mother's diet as well as mother's behavior can have long-term effects on the child's health, which would be seen when the child grows 40 years.
So, this is really interesting. That means this is an entire accumulative effect of entire history, and it starts at your birth, before your birth, rather, and then it continues throughout the life. So, this is a chronic accumulation of all these behavioral strategies, rather, and it is absolutely a dynamic way. She has sent a second question. She has asked, in view of your recent findings, if I were the director of Community Medical Trust and I had an unlimited budget for making people healthier, while specifically focusing on the increasing burden in the diabetes, what should I spend my money on? So this is purely a policy question, I think. And if he wants to ask you, like, what should be our policy move on this, if we totally believe in this concept and if we really need to cure the diabetes through this behavioral perspective?
I wish this could be true. There are a few things that I have very much in mind. Since I'm a basic biologist, I will talk about the basic things first, but we'll also talk about the clinical implications. Number one, talking about glucose, people have not sufficiently explored what happens to glucose in the brain. And I feel that glucose in the brain, glucose dynamics in the brain, has a lot to do with overall glucose homeostasis. But there is very little studies in this direction. So this is something that we need to focus upon. Then, now we know that there is an inter-organ network of molecular interactions, and there are more than 70 different molecules are involved. But how is the network arranged, and exactly how does it work, is something that has not been figured out. We only have fragmentary information that has not been put together to make a coherent sense. That is number two. Number three is the three B's coming together, that is behavior, brain, and biochemistry. These three B's have been studied traditionally by different sets of biologists. So there are biochemists, there are neurobiologists, and there are ethologists. So the three branches haven't really come together, but we will understand the systems only when these three B's come together. Well, this is on the front of basic science. On clinical front, we need to look at two things. Number one, we need better markers than glucose. Glucose has been traditionally used not only for diagnosis, but also following up the therapy and the course of development. But much of the pathology involves several other molecules, and some of them seem to work independent of glucose. So we need to look at other markers and research on them to see which are better to predict the pathology. And we need to do clinical trials on behavioral interventions directly. Right? So far we have evidence coming from animals as well as evidence which is correlational. But the ultimate test is a well-designed clinical trial.
Okay, so really we really need to answer this question on a broader scale, and there are a lot many things that are left basically to answer before we could come to any final policy conclusions to be made. Now at this point, I think we have finished with the questions sent by Radha Desai. Now we would like to move to Dr. Monish Shukla for his questions. Dr. Monish Shukla, you may proceed with your questions.
Yeah, I'm really glad to be on this panel, and I had just a few questions. I'll go in order. The first is, you know, in your model, you mentioned that there are these two states, the alpha-like and non-alpha-like, if you want, where there's one dominant and then the male. But exactly how would this model work for females? Because, you know, we generally tend to think of males being the dichotomous in terms of the alpha male and the others. And also, does it predict differences in disease incidence, for example, by gender? What's the role of gender in your model?
Yes. So since I have been talking about hunting and fighting and aggression and the physical needs of aggression. Well, it sounds like that it is all male biased, but largely the bias comes from research. The research on aggression is mostly male biased. This does not mean that aggression itself is a male specific character. Well, in primates, you find that there are hierarchies in females too. There are stronger females, and there are weaker and subordinate females. And the subordinate females have a different hormonal composition. Often they have ovulation suppression, which accompanies PCOS and insulin resistance. So this kind of changes are there in females too, but it takes a slightly different form. There are some female-specific forms of aggression, like maternal aggression, but there is very little work on this. So when we talk about aggression and the physiology of aggression, we have to talk about males because most of the research is on males. But I don't believe that it is only specific to males.
Okay, great.
Okay, that means there is a gender issue. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, Dr. Bhatt.
Okay.
Yes, there is a gender issue, and it works slightly in different way in a male, slightly different way in females, but it does work in both the genders.
I see.
Okay, that's really interesting, and still we do need to have some data on this, I guess.
Yes.
Dr. Monish, you can proceed with the second question.
Yeah, actually, I had another question, but I think it's a bit involved. So I just thought of something while you were speaking, and if I could just bring it up really quickly, which is that, you know, when you talked about behavioral deficiencies and kind of having some way of compensating for that, recent work has shown that aggressive video games have had effects both in terms of cognition and the kinds of skills that you were talking about, which is precision, reflexes, and so on. Do you think aggressive video games might have similar effects as sport, like you were suggesting?
It's possible. I feel that it is possible, but we need experiments. Okay.
Right.
Nothing can be said without experiments.
That is true. Although the experiments currently do suggest that, you know, the enhancements are exactly the thoughts that you would want to have in cognitive domain. Great. And if I can move on to a third question. This is a bit more of a sociological question, because in effect, you know, when you and you were having the discussion earlier, you were saying that how aggression has kind of gone down a lot in our societies, and effectively you want to have this behavioral compensation where you introduce aggression. But it seems to me that this might be a bit counterproductive in the long run, that we want our species to be a non-aggressive species in the long run. Now, effectively, you're saying that, you know, we are in a Stone Age mentality and you want to reintroduce Stone Age mentality like aggression almost. Wouldn't it be better to find alternatives that do not involve reintroducing aggression into a society that has already had a lot of aggression?
Yes. A very important question indeed. I should have done this earlier, but let me do it now. Is the distinction between aggression and violence? The society should go to be a non-violent society. The difference is violence is actually the intent and the act of killing and destroying. Whereas aggression refers to the neuromotor acts, the neuromotor processes that we used as a Stone Age hunter, right? Which is the neuromotor act of hitting, kicking, and so on. But this can be done in an entirely non-violent way. So, for example, a football player is aggressive but not violent, right?
Not often.
So, if you clearly distinguish between aggression and violence, then we want to suppress violence, whereas we want to encourage aggression.
I see. Excellent. That's a really important distinction. Thank you for making that.
Yes.
Thank you, Dr. Monish, for being with us. And these questions really have helped us to think on this topic in a practical term. Specifically, we really need to make it very clear in the beginning that the aggression is a different, and violence is absolutely a different issue. So if we jumble and if we really confuse between these two concepts, we will never come out with the theoretical or the practical solution to the problem, and it may have a great sociological implications and hurdles for the implementation of the theory in practice. So we also have Richa Modak with us, and I would like to request Richa to ask her question.
Richa,
hello,
you're on
Richa.
Air.
Richa, are you there?
Hello, Dr. Patel. Do you hear me?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Richa, you can ask your questions to Dr. Vatve.
Yes, thank you for bringing me on. Dr. Vatve, I have the following questions. Can this hypothesis be tested with an epidemiological implication? And in that case, what factors would we need to control for at the current state of this hypothesis to prove its effectiveness?
Yes, I believe a lot can be done at the epidemiological level. Part of it could come from data which already exists. But the problem is, while collecting data, since this hypothesis was not in mind, a number of things are missing. So, for example, we have incidence of diabetes across different occupations. But if you look at published literature, you only see that people have classified as sedentary and non-sedentary. I would be specifically interested in occupations which involve social manipulation and occupations which might be sedentary but which don't. Okay, and there should be a difference in the metabolic states of people in these two kinds of occupations. But these subtleties have not been looked at. Then we need to look at personality and metabolic state correlations. Okay, these also have not been carefully looked at, except for some abstraction about stress. Okay, but we don't see much beyond that. Then another thing I expect is population density. Population density should affect metabolic state. This is what an evolutionary theory would expect. Again, there is not much data from which you can test this.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So all these are important possible studies.
Okay. Okay, thank you. And then, so I have another question. In India, we have type 2 diabetes that often does not seem to be related to obesity. Like you said, the lean phenotype can disease. So many individuals from the SES that have a lean body type, they have this disease. Is it possible that in such individuals, their adipokine profile is different, like adiponectin, or do you think that it is something genetic where there is an overexpression of NCH or something like that? How would you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think people have been talking about genetics for a long time. But now we have the human genome, and now we can specifically look at which genes can affect this. And although people have found associations with a large number of genes, what they explain is very little. Okay, so all the genes implicated in obesity, for example, put together, explain not more than 10% of obesity variance in the population. So, really, there is a question mark whether whatever we believe to be genetic so far is really genetic or not. Okay.
Right.
But your other point is very true, that of adipokines and differential expression of adipokines. Well, adipocytes secrete a number of molecules which are called adipokines, and interestingly, adipocytes secrete both kinds of molecules. Molecules that increase insulin resistance and molecules that increase insulin sensitivity. Right? So, it is the behavior of adipocytes that is more important than how much fat you have.
Right.
But not much research has gone into this direction. We do not know what changes the adipocyte balance.
Right. Okay. Thank you so much for clearing that. Also, for an insulin-resistant individual under conditions of starvation, is glucose available to the brain? And does that reduce his BSL if it is taken up by GLUT1? In which case, can starvation be a solution or a part-time treatment for an individual to control his blood sugar level?
Yeah, well, you have really brought in a very important point, because I briefly mentioned earlier, and again, I cannot go into the details just now, but brain glucose is extremely important, but there is very little data on brain glucose, so we do not know what exactly it does, how is brain glucose level maintained, and how it affects things. There are very fragmentary kind of reports. But let me tell you that glucose supply to the brain is not so much dependent on starvation. It is dependent more on the capillary network in the brain or the glucose transporter in the blood-brain barrier. But again, there is very little data that we have in hand.
Okay, thank you so much. And I do have a last question if we have time for it. The hypothesis that gestational IR results in more investment in the offspring as higher energy is diverted through the placenta. Could you kindly elaborate on that? What is the evolutionary reasoning behind the onset of GBM?
Oh, well, insulin has a number of effects on the body which are like much beyond glucose. Insulin is essentially a molecule that fine-tunes life history strategies, what evolutionary biologists call life history strategies. And life history strategies is a sort of optimization between growth-related metabolism, reproduction, and maintenance to attain longevity. So, a very fine tuning needs to be done between these budget allocations, and insulin does mainly the role of budget allocation, right? So, how much glucose should be passed through the placenta to the baby is a matter of strategic decision for the mother. And insulin plays a major role in this. Again, I don't think we have time to go to the details, but insulin does play a main role in, along with adiponectin as well, plays a main role in regulating the flow of glucose and other nutrients through the placenta.
Right. Okay, so that's all I have.
Thank you, Richa. Thank you very much. Thank you, Monish and Pramod. Pramod, thank you so much for hosting the show today. Dr. Vatve, it was absolutely wonderful to have you on the Cure Panel Talk Show's Indian Edition. Thank you, everyone,
too,
for participating. Yes, it was a wonderful discussion, sir. If you please email me, priya@trilex.com, with your feedback and suggestions on topics that you would like to hear on the show. And the link for today's broadcast will be sent via email to all participants. Thank you very much for being with us today.